Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Democrats think they are winning the minimum wage fight nationally, despite that study from the, as I said, the John King this morning, the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office, saying that it will cost America a half a million jobs. And while legislative battle still rages, some big corporations in America on their own are raising the minimum wage of their employees. Here to talk about the public and private sector part of this major debate in America, in Studio 3 is Nancy Kane. You know Nancy is an historian at the Harvard Business School, where she holds the James E. Robeson Chair of Business Administration. Her latest book is Ernest Shackleton, Exploring Leadership. Good to see you again, Nancy.
Always a pleasure.
Thank you for being here, Nancy. Well, as Jim just talked about, this report that says that people are going to raise the minimum wage is going to cost people jobs, and the other side says it's going to lift all these people out of millions of people out of poverty. So
the study actually says both, right?
Yeah,
it's going to do both things.
It's going to do both things. So, where are you? You're a historian at Harvard Business School. You're at the Harvard Business School. Where are you on this?
And where should America be on this?
I don't actually think this one is terribly complicated, and nor are the polling numbers on this. More than 75% of Americans support, a real rise in the minimum wage. And I think that gets back to, some very strong, if you will, currents in the body politic, or, oxygenating systems in the body politic, which is people should be paid decently, fairly, for a fair day's work. And no matter how you slice the numbers at $7 and change an hour, no matter how many hours you work, piecing it together with two jobs, as millions of Americans do, you can barely scrape you and your family up to the poverty line. So we've got a prevailing standard here that doesn't allow Americans to, live a decent life, take care of their kids, and let's be, pragmatic about it, be sustained, viable consumers in the American economy. And this is part of a larger debate about income distribution that we've touched on, that you folks talk about, a great deal on the show. It's a very important debate. But this is a piece of it. And it gets, again, to these very fundamental aspects of what constitutes decent remuneration in a society that likes to believe it was founded on hard work and pulling yourself ahead by your own efforts.
I'm not surprised at all by the tenor or the content of the legislative debate. I think the whole thing is totally predictable. And as John King from CNN told us this morning, it's unlikely that Congress is going to do anything on this, at least prior to the midterm elections. What I am fascinated by is when companies like The Gap and Costco and Whole Foods, Beloco,
In-N-Out Burger,
have unilaterally decided to raise the minimum wage of their own employees. My attitude generally is, if you're doing the right thing, I don't care why you're doing it. But for purposes of this discussion, I do. Are they doing it for public relations reasons, because it raises morale and productivity? What motivates a major company to spend tens, if not hundreds of millions of dollars, to increase their employees' wages when they're not required to? And there's no union in this place requiring through collective bargaining.
So let's start with Glenn Nelson, the CEO of The Gap. He announced this as a strategic advancement. He said it's not politics. It's not being driven primarily by some kind of, coursing moral river running through the organization. It's a strategic investment. We need talented, consistent, committed, creative employees, and we believe raising the wage, right? They're going to $9 right away for 65,000 of the company's 90,000 employees in the U.S., $10 in 2015. So that's a big hike, right? We believe this is – we expect this investment to pay for itself many times over. So think about the logic behind that, taking him at the value of his words. You pay people more. There is good evidence that if you pay people more than the minimum wage, productivity goes up more than proportionally, so which is interesting. You pay them more, you're more likely to keep them, you're more likely to attract, talented people. And if you're in a business like Whole Foods or Starbucks or Costco, you are, your people, what we call your frontline employees, are your ambassadors of the brand, of the experience, of shoppers' loyalty, of what we call positive word of mouth. So every way you measure those kind of metrics, right, this paying employees well, full stop, including benefits in some cases, makes good economic sense. And P.S., there's very good data on this. So this is not something where it sounds like it makes sense. It feels good. So let's buy it on that premise. No, there's lots of good quantitative data about productivity and compensation in companies that tend to, Jim, put a high value on frontline employees. So that piece of it, that last piece of it, has to do in some sense with how you see the experience of the workers in the, on the landscape of the success of your business. Do you think that how workers experience their jobs and are compensated and enjoy respect or promotion possibilities affects your bottom line, or don't you? And the universe of corporate America is divided into two camps, and ne'er the twain shall meet.
And so let's talk now about the, not about the business, but about me or you or Marjorie, the consumer. What's the data on the issue of whether or not people make conscious decisions to patronize? I mean, the Gap, for example, while I still have problems with, I mean, you've read about it, you've probably even written about it. I mean, they're not doing the same kind things to their people doing the manufacturing in Bangladesh that they're doing with their, as you say, their frontline employees.
In the United States.
Putting that aside, and it's pretty hard to put that aside for a minute. If what is the evidence, if any, that consumers patronize or choose to patronize a place that treats its workers better than its competition does?
It's not as extensive as we'd like. It's not as...
The evidence, you're
the
saying.
Evidence okay, is not as extensive as we'd like. And a lot of the evidence is actually, interestingly enough, on the negative side. So we know that there is, and we have quantitative and qualitative data on this, we know that when a scandal breaks, or not even a scandal, just information about what's really going on the value chain in terms of how employees are treated, consumers often will react very negatively, right? There's all kinds of examples of this, including, think about Walmart and all the labor troubles it's had. Mm. One of the reasons Walmart has done so much to deal with its public relations and to deal with its employment practices is because of negative fallout from consumer perception. So we know that on the negative side, it has adverse effects. We know less, partly because it's still, honestly, Jim, an emerging phenomenon in the consuming body politic. We know less about how consumers, you know, with this amazing computer that we all have in our heads, make the choice standing there at the, you know, about where we're going to dinner or where we're going to go buy our kids' clothes or what website we're going to go on based on what they know about the values and practices of the company. We know less about that. My own, you know, educated guess, if you will, about this, or educated prediction, is that this is becoming more and more important to more people. And we know for the millennial cohort, this young group of consumers that will be more and more important as they advance in age and income earning power, for that group of people, it matters a lot.
No, I would suggest, let me say one last thing about this, Marjorie. I would suggest there's more data than you even may be aware of. When you see those ads, and maybe they're just responding to the negative, when you see the Walmart ads, I'm not a big fan of Walmart. I don't know if I've ever spent a dollar there. When they do these ads celebrating their employees, you almost want to cry. They are as – no, I'm serious. They are as good and persuasive. I have no idea if they're disingenuous or not.
Well, are so those even employees?
Well, no, they are. No, you know, well, I don't know if they're actors. Actors, so I don't know about that. Yeah, that's a very good point.
I'm suspicious.
But I guess what I want to know is, are they, in your judgment, responding, attempting to rehabilitate themselves from the negative? Oh, so it's less selling the positive for positive's sake, but rather trying to rehabilitate themselves from the negative
it's
PR
like BP,
they've got.
Like all those BP
Yeah, maybe.
Ads
well, that's a very good, that's a wonderful point. Yeah.
Yeah, it is. It is. And remember that the court of public opinion, right, as it coalesces or crystallizes around a particular company in a particular context is very, very important. It's very important. So, you know, this didn't used to be the case 25 years ago that we thought of marketing, right, and reaching out to consumers as being a battle for the hearts and minds of consumers around the values mm-hmm. and practices of the company. But let me tell you, in an age when we're down on government and we're not sure what kind of agency we have as citizens, we sure as hell want to, you know, we get the hair up on the back of our neck as consumers and we want to act on that, you know, on that ire or on that froth.
You know what I wonder about? I mean, the Gap is a lot of kids go shop there. Banana Republic, I suppose, would be young professionals. Old Navy, you go there if you have lots of kids because you can buy tons of stuff for cheap at Old Navy. But when you go into a more high-end store like a Bloomingdale's or, say, a Neiman Marcus, those are still retail workers that I mean, if they're paid the minimum wage, they sure don't look like it. They look terrific. They're usually older women, mm-hmm. but they have, you know, beautiful outfits on. Their makeup is gorgeous. The people that are selling the makeup and even in the clothes and stuff. So what about those places?
Well, so a lot of those folks are paid on commission, right? And some of those women, I mean, I'm sure you've interviewed some of them on the show over the years.
I haven't.
Right? That would be a very interesting – there are some legendary – right, sales associates at places like Saks, women who bring home six figures, well over six figures, and dress the beautiful people of our city. And there are, you know, there are those, though there are star salespeople in those kind of contexts. And there are lots of salespeople that make a better living than minimum wage because they're paid on commission. Most beauty, prestige beauty consultants, right, of whatever line
so
are paid.
So if Elizabeth Arden,
they're paid by commission. So they have a chance to make a decent, you know, a decent living because there's this important upside to it. That's not by no means true of all retail establishments, but the people that you're mentioning in general are paid on commission. That's why we don't read, you know, about strikes in Bloomingdale's or Neiman Marcus, like, you know, worker unionization efforts in the same way we do in, say, fast food restaurants.
Okay.
So the pay structure is different.
So, Nancy, let's assume you're doing one of the you don't call them trainings. Whatever you do for executives.
Facilitations,
okay. Pardon me.
Coaching.
When you're doing a coaching for executives, and one of the executives raises his or her hand and says, I don't want to hear about your views on social justice. Mm-hmm. I want to hear your views about what's good for business. Mm-hmm. I am thinking about raising the minimum wage for my 72,000 employees. Again, no bleeding heart stuff.
Right,
know
right,
what's right for people. I want to know what's good. What do you say to them?
I say, you know, look at these companies and why they are doing this. Look at Costco, for example, which is a company that is known to, you know, come down to the penny, you know, the fractions of pennies with suppliers about what the cost of goods is that they buy, that they'll sell in their stores. At the same time, you know, going all the way back to the founder, Sigelman, of the company, there's this philosophy that if we pay people, our associates in the stores well, we create a good consumer for our products, if you will. But we also create a very, very good disciple of the experience, of the merchandise, of the Costco brand in a land, discount, mass kind of warehouse merchandising, where there's often not a big premium put on that, so it creates some differentiation. So I tell them to go off and look at the data on companies that make this decision, right, that don't seem to have are not waving a flag of social justice in front of the front door. And there's lots of good evidence on that. Think about Whole Foods. John Mackey hates unions. He's a libertarian.
Hates Obamacare, too.
Right. He's the founder of Whole Foods, and yet his people are by all other retail metrics, well compensated with all kinds of bonus possibilities and access to, you know, what other people, executives in the company are paid, and a whole host of policies that many of us would say sound incredibly progressive and liberal. And yet he says this isn't about liberal or, you know, conservative. It's about running a good business.
Huh. Where does Trader Joe's fit into all this?
They fit into this camp as well.
Okay.
Very much so.
You ever gone to Costco and bought a jar of olives that is larger than you are, Nancy Kane? You really, trust me, apparently you have not, you haven't lived until you've bought either a jar of mayonnaise or a jar of olives that is roughly half your size.
227 rolls of paper towels. That's always the problem. Where do you put all that
stuff? You know, we only have 30 seconds. Like, you know what drives me, I don't know if I said this to you or to Marjorie about a week ago, what drives me nuts about this discussion is I am of the camp that don't need convincing. The minimum wage is both a socially just and economically just thing. But then you say, in the words of the great Peggy Lee, is that all there is? So you win the national fight, you get to $10.10 an hour. You win the fight in Massachusetts, you get to $11 an hour. And the person's still making $20,000 a year.
So, all right. So I think it's ironic that the same day that, you know, Facebook announced a $19 billion acquisition
of WhatsApp,
right, Gap decides to announce the minimum wage. We have a long way to go on building a stable middle class beyond raising the minimum wage.
What should it be, the minimum wage?
Amen.
$20, $30, $40?
Fifth. Let's start with fifth.
Okay, why not?
Nancy, good to see you.
Nancy Kane is a historian at the Harvard Business School, where she holds the James E. Robeson Chair of Business Administration. Her latest book, Ernest Shackleton, Exploring Leadership. Nancy, great as always to talk to you. And thank you guys for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Tune in tomorrow. Boston Globe editor Brian McGroy will be with us. We'll also have tips on avoiding Downton Abbey withdrawal with wine expert Jonathan Alsop and food writer Corby Kummer. Our show is a production of WGBH Boston Public Radio, our production team, Chelsea Murs, Will Roselip, Amanda McGowan, and John Parker. I'm Marjorie Egan.
And we both want to thank all of you. As we said at the top of the show, it is our one-year anniversary. Thanks for being with us, and we're looking forward to a great second year.
We sure are.
I'm Jim Browdy.
See you later.